Investors Chronicle.
Welcome, one and all, to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 14th of March at the time of recording, and it's another action-packed show today. Coming up, we look at TP ICAP, the interdealer broker that emerged from the business once managed by Terry Smith, and the potential IPO action on the cards there. This week's magazine is our annual ISA special, so it features a big supplement telling you all you need to know about the UK's favourite tax-free savings plan. We'll discuss some of the big issues of the moment relating to ISAs, from how best to use them in conjunction with pensions to what investment platform you might want to use and so on. And finally, we look at a couple of infrastructure solutions businesses. If you'll forgive that very dry description, the companies themselves are a little more interesting. That's MidCap Hill & Smith and SmallCap Costain. Over the line to discuss some of this with me today, Julian Hoffman. Hi, Julian.
Hello there.
And in the studio, Mark Robinson.
How's it going, Dan?
Very well, thank you, Mark. Val Cipriani.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Val. And Alex Newman.
Hello.
Hi, Alex. We'll start then with TP ICAP, the interdealer broker. As we were just saying before we came on air, effectively, it used to, or still does to a certain extent, involve brokers ringing up people to trade off exchange securities, and now belatedly it's getting technology involved in the process. There's a lot of things to talk about here, though. We'll start with the figures that came out a few days ago, Julian. How did they look in and of themselves?
It wasn't a bad result, particularly for TP ICAP. I mean, the main feature, I think, was that they saw an improvement in their overall margins, which at on an adjusted basis were 13% in these results, which is broadly, that's doubled over the last 2 years. So there is definitely a sense that they're getting on top of some of their costs. The costs also came down, well over 40 million of savings they made in these results. It's a very, as you alluded to, a very people-heavy business still. They employ about 2,500 brokers who presumably all wear red braces and shout sell or buy down the phone. But it is an interesting result as well, because they are talking openly about how to get more value out of the business. So, there were suggestions that they might do a partial IPO of some of their data, their data business, which is called Parameter or Parameta, however you want to call it. But the headline results themselves were reasonably positive, although they are still booking quite high impairments to one of their acquisitions, the LiquidNet acquisition. There was another 128 million impairment on that. They paid 452 million for it a few years ago, so it already seems to have lost a quarter of its goodwill in terms of write-downs, and that's all to do with the volatility of the block equities market, which is essentially what their core business is. Encouraging on some levels, intriguing on others, and overall sort of just about acceptable. I think that's the way you could sum it all up.
Yeah. So the business, for those who don't know, I suppose to go in a bit more detail, it can be quite confusing, but effectively they match institutional buyers and sellers for over-the-counter business, which effectively means anything that isn't traded on an exchange. They are a leader in this market, have a 40% market share. There's only two or three people who do this kind of thing. That said, as we've alluded to already, this is a business that's changed a lot over the past 15, 20 years. A lot more stuff inevitably being done online electronically nowadays, and they've had to shift with that. They've made a lot of acquisitions as well, as you remark upon, Julian, which is partly why the impairments are still coming through, because they've rolled up a lot of the companies who were involved in this and who time maybe overtook. But the latest aspect isn't so much an acquisition as the spin-off, this data business. This is something that some investors have been pushing for, wanting them to realize some value there. Parameter, as you say, it's called. It sounds like what they want to do now is an IPO of a minority stake in the business. What do we think about the prospects there? There's been some valuations attached to that fairly promising. This is, you know, data clearly is a popular area to be in. At the same time, of course, I think in the past they've said, well, we don't want to spin off this business because part of its worth is dependent on all our other business arms. So maybe a minority stake is the best way to realize some of that value. What are your thoughts?
I mean, it's an interesting and intriguing idea, I think. As you say, the data or market data is really where the value is nowadays. And we can see that at sort of fusty old companies like the LSE, which have suddenly become quite tech heavy and with a valuation to match. The company's argument is that in its current form, Parameter just isn't valued as part of the structure of TP ICAP. Everyone sees this big legacy business. I mean, it's a chunky proportion of the group's total sales. So it's about 8 point something percent, just over 8% of the total sales. What I'm not entirely sure is how much they'll realize from a minority stake, but they could obviously, if it becomes a structure in its own right, that majority stake could potentially become quite valuable if people start seeing it as a separate from the core business, but, you know, part of the total value of ICAP itself. It's an intriguing idea, and I mean, it's essentially they've been bullied into it by an activist investor over the past couple of years. So, although they're describing it as an option, I think you can almost take it as read that is what's going to happen, because that's the only way they're going to keep their shareholders happy. But I haven't actually seen myself what the valuation is, so maybe if someone comes up with that number, then that would be quite useful.
Yeah,
or I can click it up, and we can just interpolate it.
I've seen some suggestions around the region of the 1 billion mark, which is pretty high when you consider the TP ICAP business market cap is about 1.6, I think, and shows maybe how that value isn't being recognised at the moment. Of course, the proof will be in the pudding.
I mean, you should sort of caveat that by saying that all potential IPOs, if they're being paraded around the market, are always put at one billion, aren't they?
But it's true. It's a nice round figure.
It's a nice round figure. It wouldn't surprise me if they could get something like that. I mean, data is isn't the last commodity that people will pay a premium for. I think that's the best way of describing it. And the other way, of course, is if ICAP cuts back its expenses accounts, that'll probably boost the profitability considerably as well. But it is an interesting. The only question about it is whether the market conditions will allow them to realize that value at the moment, or whether they need to wait, particularly until some kind of future on interest rates is established, and then they could IPO it at a reasonable level. The only question mark is whether they launch it now, whether they would actually undershoot what they expect for it.
Well, on the savings side, they did also note that broker productivity was up, I think, 12%, which is probably partly related to this new Fusion platform they're rolling out, very much part of the shift to an entirely electronic broking system, which may eventually do away with the brokers entirely. So,
The meters will mean fewer lunches, I think, is the sort of the caveat to that. It is surprising that they're so manpower heavy, I think. I think, as I mentioned, they still have 2,500 people working the phones. And, so you look at companies that are platform-based like CMC or Plus 500, admittedly, they're slightly different business models, but they're very, very people-light and technology-heavy. And it's probably overdue that TP ICAP goes in that direction. So you kind of wonder whether they aren't going to see quite a lot of savings out of the 1.3 billion they currently spend on staff costs.
Mm. Alex, what are your views on the company?
Well, it's a difficult one. I think they, let's maybe start with the valuation. So they trade on their 7x forward earnings. They're still quite a chunky discount to NAV, hence the buyback they've just announced, because they're keen to close that. And hence all this talk around Parameter. I mean, one of the probably sort of dropped in there by a shareholder to one FT report I saw was, you know, this could go to as much as £1.5 billion, which, okay, fine. And a nice anonymous quote there, and we don't have to place too much weight on it. But as Julian said, the legacy business still remains a big part of the investment case, and it's not really delivered. I mean, I think the return on equity over the last half decade has been something like 3.7% per year. At the same time, it's clear that investors really have lost faith in management's ability to respond to both the environment and the cyclicality of their end market. So, you know, being focused on energy and commodities, it isn't always ideal, but also in just how they're able to move the business along, as we've sort of discussed. So this probably for investors doesn't fall into the quality camp of share. Where it might be an interesting case, I think, as we've sort of discussed, is it a value stock? Is there something inside the business that is really, really not being valued correctly? And this is the, you know, the 1 billion, 1.5 billion, whatever it is, value we can attach to Parameter. So the most recent numbers, 189 million in revenues, looks like something about 100 million of costs. So, this is a decent margin business within the within TP ICAP. I think it's not always the case that you can just pluck out divisions or assets within companies and say, look, this asset's not being valued correctly, because they are monetizing their own data belatedly. And even though they've put it into this legal entity, the ability to separate it from TP ICAP when it seems they're very reliant on the data is just a very confusing proposition to me. So long term, you know, what's the long term standalone value of a business that is dependent on the parent's data flows and essentially the parent's control? You're not going to be able to realise full value, because it's essentially just a cost centre or a profit centre within the business. So it looks like they've moved divisional revenues from other parts of the business into this in the last couple of years. I don't want to say it feels like, you know, they're trying to pull a rabbit out of a hat here, but obviously they're under considerable pressure to show that there is quality within the business. And all of a sudden we're talking about, you know, a 1 billion business tucked away within what seems to have been long term a kind of failing business. It just seems a little bit convenient to me. I don't quite buy it, to be honest, but that might be my cynicism with just seeing how, I suppose, this company's not really been able to respond to market pressures, you know, over the last 5 years. So I would have my doubts, basically.
Yeah, that, even a minority stake, of course, that would still be valued based on the question of its standalone value, which, as you say, may not be quite what it's being billed to be. We'll see with that. The other aspect of the business we alluded to earlier is the LiquidNet acquisition, and this is one of several it's done over the years, but one that it launched a rights issue to pay for in 2021. It hasn't really paid off at all. Julian, you mentioned the impairment cost there. There were some decent synergies, I think, cost savings, that is to say, in these figures for the year just gone. And some brokers are hopeful that this business will start to perform finally. But so far, it's proven a very expensive acquisition with not much going for it. The business is, it's more to do, as I understand it, with fund managers rather than other institutions buying and selling assets.
They tend to market to individual. Yeah, I mean, it's an individual manager thing. You know, if they have spare funds, and they interdeal broke with each other. So supposedly that creates more liquidity. But as you said, it's not. It hasn't proved to be particularly profitable. Which is why a quarter of the value has already been written down, less than 2 years after the rights issue to buy it. The problem, of course, is that none of this, if you're seeing the middles taking a percentage it doesn't really take much in the, to change in the conditions for that to come under pressure. And that's really the problem that TP ICAP's had, is that it's sort of reliant now on a level of volatility all the time that guarantees volume, but it doesn't seem to be able to, because its cost base is so high and so fixed because of all these thousands of brokers they employ, that operational gearing goes very quickly into reverse, and that it seems to be everything in the business apart from their parameter division, which is the one they're trying to sell off. Or at least, you know, sort of stake in. It's not a promising scenario, and I think the only thing that will help it in the long run is if they do completely digitalize, and you won't have people shouting sell into phones anymore, and that might be the only way that they can make any money, really.
Yeah, well, I think with Liquidnet as well, they do want to, it's a cash equities business, but the idea was to move into bonds and swaps, which is easier said than done given competition there with, you know, Bloomberg, Tradeweb.
I mean, it's a very competitive market, so it's not that wasn't an easy move by any means, so it needed kind of perfect execution, and that's been in short supply with this company, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, as with some other companies we've discussed in recent weeks, you are still being paid to wait, as we say, because there is a good dividend yield there. And I think Liquidnet, the credit side of things, you hear a lot of talk about private credit nowadays. So clearly they still have hopes for that side as well. We'll keep a close eye on it and what's going to happen with the IPO as well. We will keep you posted and they'll keep us posted. But for now, we are turning to our cover story this week, which is our ISA special, a big supplement, as I say, covering everything you need to know. We are going to focus in on a few things in particular, though, not the UK ISA, because we discussed that last week. But why don't we start with something quite simple, Val, which is every year people always say, not unreasonably, use it or lose it, make use of the allowance before it goes at the end of the tax year. You can't roll it over. And this year that is more important in some ways than before, given the allowances for an unwrapped account are being reduced again next tax year.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, taxes for investors are in practice going up again next year. So people will probably remember that that happened last April as well, and it's happening again now. So the capital gains tax allowance is going down from £6,000 now to £3,000 next year. And the dividend allowance is being also halved from £1,000 to £500. So basically, if you do the maths between the two of them, if you are a high rate taxpayer, that is potentially an increase of in taxes of £769. So it's quite like a chunky sum potentially. And so basically in the last couple of years, taxes for investors have increased quite a lot. You have a £20,000 annual allowance that kind of protects you from all of these. So basically it's a bit of a no-brainer that you should use it if you can. So the way you should think about it is that if at some point you need the money in the future and you hold the investments outside a wrapper, you don't really have a lot of time of sort of space to gradually cash in the gains, because these allowances have gone down and they will now be quite low. So it just kind of makes more sense to sort of protect it from the start. And then if you need it, you can cash it in any time.
Though we're not talking about the UK ISA, we'll go back a few months to the autumn statement and the simplification changes they made there, which may be tinkering around the edges a little bit because there are a lot of ISAs now and a lot of complications still. But maybe we should outline what those changes were and what they mean for ISAs in the months ahead.
Yeah, there were a lot of talks, like there often are, before the autumn statement about a big simplification of the ISA system. And instead, what was announced were like a few relatively small changes that are now going to become effective from April. So in a way, they aren't a huge deal, but they can be useful, and it's kind of good to be aware of them. So I think two main things. The probably more useful one is that you can now subscribe to multiple ISAs of the same time during the same tax year. So basically, long story short, as of now, you can put 10K in a stocks and share ISA and 10K in a cash ISA, but you cannot put 10K each into different cash ISAs. which is admittedly a bit inconvenient. From April, you will be able to do that if you want to. And I mean, the kind of situations where it comes handy is, for example, for investors, if you want to have two different stocks and share sizes on two different platforms, because different platforms will obviously charge you in different ways for different styles of investing or for different assets. That can become quite useful. So, for example, you can have, you know, open-ended funds for the long term on one platform, and then if you kind of like having a smaller portfolio of, say, individual stocks where you trade a bit more, you kind of like take a bit more risk, you can have it on a different platform where, for example, trading is free. So that is kind of useful. And again, the other thing is if you want to have two different cash sizes, for example, a fixed rate one and an easy access one, which obviously fit different financial goals, you can also do that. So I think, in my opinion, that is kind of like the most useful thing that is happening in April, ISA-wise. And then the other sort of smaller thing is that right now you can obviously transfer your ISA to a different provider. But if you're moving money that you have paid in the same tax year, you need to move basically all of it in one go. Whereas again, from next year, you will be able to make partial transfers between ISA providers, which again gives you a bit extra flexibility depending on what you want to do and looking for the best deals and rates and stuff. So yeah, they're not huge changes, but they can come handy in some situations, I suppose.
And of course, these changes will depend on platforms being able to get into gear and provide them. Because I can imagine with the partial ISA transfers, you'll find various providers won't do that to begin with. So in some ways, it adds even more complexity. But at least they're trying. On the subject of platforms, you spoke about it a bit there. But one thing it's interesting to flag, we do discuss it in print on various occasions, is that some of the platforms which are typically deemed to be fairly expensive, the big well-known platforms, actually, whether it be an ISA or something else, are not so expensive if you're only focused on exchange-traded securities, i.e. ETFs, investment trusts, shares, because they do have upper limits on overall costs, which makes them quite cost-effective.
Yeah, that's correct. So basically, we think about certain platforms as being very expensive. And I mean, they can be, but mostly we're talking about open-ended funds when we're saying that. Whereas if you only hold those assets, what they do is basically they charge the same percentage-based fee. So say, you know, 0.25% on the sort of annual holdings, but then they will cap that fee to what is in fact a fairly low level. So, you know, you can get an ISA with, say, AJ Bell, for example, for £42 a year, and Hargreaves with 45 if you only hold those specific assets. So again, that's single stocks, investment trusts, and ETFs, and does not apply to open-ended funds. Of course, you do need to keep an eye at that point on the dealing fee, because that does apply for all those assets again. And in some cases, it can be quite expensive. So this applies basically if you only hold those assets and if you don't trade very much during the year.
Mm. And also for those who trade US shares, which is an increasing number of people who hold them at least, the FX fee as well, which can be very annoying and very high on a lot of platforms. Our ISA special does have a big table with all the charges so you can compare and contrast across all the metrics that are relevant to you. Let's talk about asset allocation in a way now, I suppose, because ISAs are typically viewed, not unreasonably, as very distinct from pensions, given the different tax treatments, etc. But you can use them in conjunction with pensions as part of a holistic retirement planning strategy, I suppose. And we talk about that a bit in the special as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, definitely, you know, when you're thinking about retirement, you want to think about your pension. And when you're putting, like, the money away, it's a no-brainer, because the tax advantages, like, the boost you get from those extra tax relief is really quite high, and it kind of like grows very nicely in the long term. But then once you get to the point when you do retire, ideally you do want to have some money in your ISAs as well. And so basically what you can do is use them together. So the kind of issue here is that when you take money from a pension is basically like like taxed as income. Whereas when you take money from an ISA, it is then tax-free. So if you want to have a bit of a higher income, the pension becomes a slightly less tax-efficient place where to get money from, because once you get to the higher rate income tax band, obviously the rate is 40%, so it kind of like eats away at your money quite a bit. So the way you can do it instead, if you kind of, you know, have the ISA funds available, is that you get to the basic rate tax limit with the pension, and this obviously will include your state pension as well if you have it. And then you can kind of like nicely top it up with the ISA and never sort of end up in the 40% tax rate, even if, you know, effectively you are withdrawing a bit more money than that. And that, again, is becoming quite relevant because the income tax rate bans have been frozen for a couple of years and are set to remain so. So that means that the state pension takes up a bigger part of your income, and that, you know, basically the real kind of like real value of this threshold is decreasing quite significantly and quite quickly. So, you know, getting to the higher income rate is not really that high, especially if potentially, you know, you're by yourself and not in a couple, because when there's two people, you've got kind of like two sets of allowances that you can play with a little bit. But if you're by yourself, your expenses will potentially be higher, and then you don't have that much flexibility. So the ISAs can kind of give you that instead. And then the other two kind of like useful things you can use ISAs for in retirement are like if you need to make a big purchase of some kind, or if you want to retire very early. Because obviously pension money, the access is now at the age of 55 and it's going to increase to 57 in 2028. In line with the increase to the state pension age. So if you want to retire really early, you cannot put all your money in the pension, because then you will not have access to it in time, basically.
Mm. There are other aspects of tax planning we talk about in relation to junior ISAs and inheritance tax and things like that, but we'll put them aside for now and talk about people who are more likely to be at the beginning of their saving journey and use the lifetime ISA, because this is another ISA that was billed at launch as a way to save for either for retirement or for a house. But there have been some concerns about some of the rules here. And as of yet, there's been no changes to those rules, despite, again, speculation to the contrary in recent weeks.
Yeah, I think LISAs are another like area where there's always like a lot of discussion, because people in this industry, I think, are quite keen to see some changes there. And it's basically two sort of aspects of the argument. The first one is that, you know, if you withdraw the cash for any reason that is not buying your first home, or, you know, once you turn 60, so for retirement, you're penalized, and it's a 20% penalty on the amount you withdraw, which is, in fact, if you do the maths, higher than the sort of bonus that the government gives you for saving in the LISA. So you kind of like get back in a way less than you put in. So there's definitely some people arguing that that is not entirely fair in principle, because anyway, you are kind of like punishing people who are sort of just like trying to save money and do their best for their finances. And then there is sort of a second point, which is that you can use the money you have in the lifetime ISA to buy your first home, as long as the first home is not worth more than £450,000. And obviously that limit was set quite a few years ago, and in the meanwhile, house prices have gone up quite a lot. So again, the real value of that threshold has gone down significantly. And so I think one of the more like recent campaigns, which was from Martin Lewis, a money saving expert, was specifically about kind of like changing or reducing the penalty for the first time buyers that end up buying a property with that money that is worth more than 450K, for this precise reason, basically, because it's just kind of like quite easy to go above the threshold, especially, for example, if you're buying in London, where obviously houses are very expensive. So yeah, a lot of discussion around all of that. It did not happen. It might still come up potentially in the autumn statement if we do get one before the election.
Yeah, the lifetime ISA, or LISA, as you say, it does have this a government bonus of 25% on contributions up to £4,000 a year, which is what attracted a lot of people to it in the first place. But yes, there are those complications to watch out for as well. Martin Lewis said that Jeremy Hunt or someone close to Jeremy Hunt, I can't remember, had told him that they were saving this for a big housing offer pre-election, or when property prices improve is the way they termed it. So whether that comes pre-election or not remains to be seen, but you suspect it might be something in the very least a manifesto, if not a pre-election statement. But that, of course, raises questions as to whether it will actually happen. We will see. As I keep saying, that is our cover story this week, the ISA supplement. So if you are interested in the foibles and the quirks and the ways to best use an ISA, do pick that up. We are going to finish, though, with a couple of companies who also have reported in recent days. Hill & Smith, to begin with. Mark, you covered these results. Business used to be, over 100 years ago now, used to be an ironmonger, and now involved in things like road safety barriers, things like that. It's involved in the US a lot. It's increasingly doing a lot of business over there in relation to infrastructure projects. How did its figures look?
Well, broadly positive, of course. And it's funny you should mention the US, because it seems to be the bulk of the revenue growth is assembled among the five subsidiary companies it has over in the US. It's six now, actually, because they did announce the acquisition of a company called FM Stainless. The areas that they highlighted in the US were composites and electrical utility, and basically that involves the supply of engineered steel for a range of infrastructure uses, including energy generation and distribution. When you look at the numbers as well, you can see there's been a definite slant towards that side of the Atlantic as well. About half of revenues are generated now in the US, about £460 million. But perhaps more tellingly, when you look at underlying operating profit, 76% of that came from stateside too. It's the fastest growing, the fastest growing elements of the business are located in the US. And of course, all this is backed by the unprecedented level of infrastructure spending that we're seeing. I say spending that we're seeing already. A lot of the $1.25 trillion that has been passed under the Biden administration is pretty much still sitting in federal accounts. And so within the results as well, there was projections of 5 to 10 year time frames for a lot of these things too, which obviously gives a lot of visibility in terms of revenue. The trouble is with that money that's sitting in federal accounts is a lot of it is linked to matching principles with the states as well. So the states have to obviously come up with the same or a proportional amount to get those federal funds released. That hasn't been happening, and you would imagine that it will tend to happen on states whose state and municipal budgets are relatively healthy. So yeah, you can understand the gradual switch in favour of that market. I mean, it seems to be happening in so many other industries at the moment, given growth rates in the US. So there we have it. Costain, by contrast, there, I guess the one of the principal drivers for that business is the fact that they they're engaged primarily in what might be termed sustainable infrastructure developments. And so they're going to receive and have received a degree of mandated support. And that was highlighted by a contract that they received from Transport for London in the lead up to the release of the results too. It's on a completely different scale, and I would imagine that scale is actually spreading somewhat, given that constant currency revenue growth at Hill & Smith was about 14%, and that's sort of fairly large business too. So it's another case that we're seeing a lot more activity across the Atlantic.
And before we return to the US, there's a particular question there that I'll come to, but I think you wanted to say a bit about contracting practices in general and how they're changing somewhat.
Yeah, it just occurred to me when I was looking at both results there, and I was thinking in terms of, if you're looking at it from an investment perspective, I think the important thing to look at is the level of onerous contracts, legacy contracts that these companies have on their books. In the case of both these companies, this doesn't seem to be an issue now. But, you know, within living memory, of course, we had the example of Carillion, which was a complete and utter disaster. And you only have to go back about 10 years and look at the support services sector as well. And we had a succession of profit warnings over a fairly lengthy 2 to 3 year period, I think it was, because of these onerous contracts on legacy issues as well. And that's because, the blame for that has gone on to the clamour for the public-private partnerships, and the fact that both central government and municipal entities had outsourced so much of that work. There was tremendous opportunities for the outsourcers, and they were thinking, again, you know, this provides great revenue visibility. But of course, the tendering process was flawed. There wasn't enough flexibility built into some contracts and too much flexibility built into others. And so you saw a lot of, they obviously entered a lot of contracts on a sort of a rash basis, and that came out through the wash eventually. So I would just say to investors, when you're looking at any of these type of engineering companies, even given the amounts of capital that's available in the US market, for instance, they have to be very careful about how that tendering process has been taken out. And I guess you get clues looking at things like the operating cash flow that's generated on revenue growth. These different types of cash metrics are quite useful in that regard.
When we look at the fundamentals of Hill & Smith, a year ago, it set out targets, a financial framework, if you will, wanting to deliver 15% cash profit margin in fiscal 2024. So that's the coming year. It was at 14.8% this year, and the highest margin divisions are growing the fastest as well. So it seems well set there. Potential for another increase too. Return on invested capital is going up. How do we see the business in the context of the valuation at the moment? Is there more to come?
I think what they've achieved thus far is all the more impressive, given that they've been pursuing an M&A policy as well. So, I mean, that's always that can be dilutive in the short term. So, I mean, they deserve credit, but I wouldn't ascribe too much importance on those targets going forward. I think they're for the benefit of management rather than shareholders. The Hill & Smith is trading slightly above its long-term average at the moment, but the value there really lies in that in the structural drivers going forward, and the signs there are positive too. So, it's not extortionately expensive at the moment. I think there's trading at about 17 times for, and some might say that's a bit rich for an infrastructure provider. But it's kind of in a growth market at the same time. So we stuck to our guns.
Mm. The final point: if you look at their revenue split, I think it's 56% from the US now, or it was last year. 3/4 of operating profit from the US. With any business like this nowadays, there's the question of, will it consider a US listing, a US primary listing? If so, you know, when that happens, we have seen big share price uplifts in anticipation of high valuations in the US, et cetera, et cetera. The counterpoint maybe is that at its current size, it's not quite big enough to be in the US market or to have a foothold in the US market in terms of the public listing market, that is, rather than the underlying markets which it serves. What do we think about the prospects of Hill & Smith following some others across the Atlantic?
Well, naturally, I think it just depends on whether that proportion keeps on growing. And I guess I haven't looked at it myself, but I think it pays to have a look at the ownership breakdown as well, because that can be a significant driver of, you know, the push the push overseas. You know, we've seen it so often. But I take your point. I mean, at the moment, given its relative size, it's probably not on the drawing board. But as that proportion increases and the scale of the company increases, you know, who knows? Hopefully, the UK stock market would have bounced back by then.
Mm. Well, hope springs eternal. That, though, does mean the end of the show. We are nearing time, unfortunately. We do have a bit more to say on Costain, but we will save that for a future episode because we are going to be covering it in the weeks ahead in print. But all that remains to say is thank you very much to everyone for contributing. Thank you to Julian, to Alex, to Mark, to Val, to our producers this week, Victoria Thornton and Maddie Apthorpe. And thank you to you for listening. We'll see you next time on another Companies and Markets show.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.